Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Dark All Day by Brendan Carlson. Narrated by Paul Heitch. Like an unchecked cancer, hate corrodes the personality, destroys a man's sense of values and his objectivity. It causes him to describe the beautiful as ugly and the ugly as beautiful, and to confuse the true with the false, and the false with the true. Martin Luther King, Jr. Chapter 1. It was Wednesday, January 9, 1918, when I returned to the United States on a ship with several hundred other veterans. Most of the crew space had been used for cargo storage, seeing as less than half the men who went to Europe had come back. The Sinclair brothers, Patrick and Edward, and I were part of the Cornell detachment, along with 572 other men who had gone to war from the same school. Now there were less than 200 of us left, and only one Sinclair brother had made it back. The New York harbor was dusted in snow, the time of year finally making itself known, with people wearing furs and coats and gloves. Before I left, I saw a country so vivid and venerable and, of course, hopeful that this war and its victory that we were so sure of would bring us glory. And here I was with about 150 or so survivors, and we all just saw ancient concrete and empty promises. Victory had been grasped, but while the men and women back here could revel in it, we had borne the cost. I don't think I ever voted again after that war. Stepping off the ship, I spotted someone I hadn't expected to show up, my father. I thought he'd disowned me as his son, like my mother did. And yet there he was, at the end of the docks, ready to meet his 19-year-old son wearing military BDU. I was hesitant, freezing upon recognizing him. But I soon wormed out of my shock and approached. He was thinner back then, with his hair cut prim and proper like any other American gentleman who worked with money. You could tell he was Italian, perhaps from the way he carried himself, or perhaps because of the cross around his neck and the broad nose stuck between his tiny eyes. He stood too straight, spoke too hard, and looked too casual picking me up. "Dad?" I greeted him, carrying a rucksack over my shoulder. "Elias," Gino Ferra replied in a stern voice. "Plan on telling me how I fucked up everything?" "No, no, that isn't why I'm here." I could tell Dad wanted to be angry, but I was still his son. His son with a gaunt face, a malnourished figure, stubble where there had once been clean-shaven cheeks. "I'm taking you home." "Don't." I began walking, forcing Dad to catch up to me. "Just bring me back to Cornell." "Cornell?" I was part of the Cornell detachment. I imagined they'd want surviving undergraduates to return to their studies. I still have a scholarship. We approached my dad's Model T, and I climbed into the passenger seat. The silence in the car as we headed to the university was unbearable for my dad, no doubt, but for me, it was comforting. I had spent the past year surrounded by either shouting or gunfire, and so the sound of wind and calm snowfall was absolute heaven. I just wished I was enjoying the ambience in a different country. "Son," Gino began. "Don't," I snapped back. "Just don't." I returned to classes the same day. After confirming that I was alive by mentioning my real surname, I was given a schedule and told I was late for the start of the semester. An hour later, I was in a classroom for advanced chemistry with the same professor I had been taught by more than a year before. Nothing had changed. The seats still creaked, the air was dusty, the old codger up front still acted like some military man with command over us. But the one noticeable difference about the classroom was how empty it was. Before, there had been over 50 people in this classroom, one of the largest on campus. And now there were 8, myself included. Looking to my left, there was an empty spot where Barney Birmingham had sat. I remember how he died, skulking around the trenches, leading a squad through to get a bead on an enemy position. He'd taken a belt of machine gun fire after prematurely jumping out of a trench. In front of me was an empty seat for Ryan Greer, who was killed piloting a manual. He was hit by German artillery shells, splitting him and his machine open, showering me and my companions in blood and intestines and God knows what else. Behind me was an empty seat for Devin Richardson, who was killed by his own men. He was coming back from a nighttime op, scouting ahead for an assault that didn't get past the planning stage. A sleep-deprived and paranoid sniper spotted the movement in the forward trenches and fired, putting 3 bullets through Devin, his screams filling the night until morning, when they realized they had shot one of their own men. To my right was another empty spot, where Edward Sinclair had once sat. I never got to see how he died. On Wednesday, February 7, 1934, I woke up at my desk. Right, not my desk. Mine was a smoldering hole in the side of a skyscraper. My temporary desk at Alan's apartment. My reflexes took over as I reached for a cigarette and my lighter, an action I was unable to complete given my missing hand. The metallic stump hit the lighter, knocking it onto its side, and I spotted the gleaming chrome prosthetic sitting nearby. Right, I groaned, suddenly feeling my age and my experiences hit me like a truck. I stuck the pack in my right armpit while my intact left hand extracted and lit a dart. The etched eye on the lighter's base kept staring back at me, only breaking eye contact after I pushed it into my pocket. The desk was overpopulated with stuff. Just stuff. Paper receipts I had written in terrible handwriting. A pen holder. My pack of cigarettes. A phone. A small newfangled mini-terminal, or mini-T as it was marketed, that I had borrowed from Alan. A wooden mallard my brother had sculpted for me years ago. And a picture of me and the boys from the 5th. The latter two items were the only things I had taken from my old apartment after it had literally blown up in my face. Another day on the clock, huh? I asked the wooden duck. It stared back at me. I knew it was always listening, even if it didn't react to me. Yeah, I feel that, I said to its answering silence. Pushing myself up, I turned to see the spray of plate light shooting through the poorly drawn blinds, which meant the light and heat must have been the culprits for waking me up. The clock in here read 8 o'clock, which was pretty good considering that I was still used to waking up at 9 at night. I went to the sink in the bathroom down the hall, turning on the flickering light, and ran cold water over my metal-capped wrist. Shit, that was cold. Grabbing a pipe cleaner, I stuffed it inside the plugs that lead to my nerves, cleaning out the crap that builds up over the day and night. Green pus poured out. Less than before, which meant things were only getting better, and I was adjusting to the augment well. I wasn't too keen on it still, but I didn't have much choice in that department. Washing the utensil and my hand, I wandered back to my desk. Grabbing my mechanical palm, I shoved the gleaming spoke into my wrist and twisted, a click signaling the proper connection with the electrodes. My imaginary muscle movements translated once again into mimicked mechanical movements. I tested it out by opening the blinds and was immediately assaulted by more plate light searing my corneas. I backed away from the window, hitting my desk, making papers and other items tumble to the floor. I heard the front door open and merely looked at my holster instead of brandishing the weapon it held. Thankfully, I'd been less twitchy recently. Through the open door, I peered down the hall, seeing the main entrance occupied by a bulky figure in a light coat, carrying a briefcase in one hand and an umbrella in the other. Yuri Sametsky, former Russian Cossack and street meat vendor, currently my secretary. He'd lost weight now that he actually had decent food in his stomach and a regular place to sleep. Plus, having to run from his apartment to here every morning gave him more exercise than standing around a cart ever did. He had cut his hair short and left his beard unruly, and while both were edging on gray, his stoic Slavic face didn't look a day over 40.
Mr. Roche, good morn.
Yuri, always chipper.
You look like you didn't sleep well.
I didn't, I confirmed, groaning, my throat parched and my body aching. I spent more days here than I'd care to admit. I looked at the calendar Yuri had pinned to the wall above the desk, seeing the date. I had an appointment for the damned wrist. Empty checkups I dumped money into for them to say all was well and good. It's better than dying of rust rot, whatever that was. Alan not here? I called out, getting my coat and pulling my snagged mechanical hand from wherever it had gotten caught this time.
Niet, not here. No car outside. Must be working.
Working my ass. I knew the schedules of the Fifth Precinct. I worked them for years, and Alan was definitely not spending every waking moment serving and protecting. I'd deal with that later.
Yuri, I got somewhere to be. Mind tagging along? I asked, grabbing the mallard as an afterthought.
The Russian man smiled as he stood, following me out and relocking the door to the apartment. Well, he didn't need much in the way of convincing. Trudging down two flights of dirty and dingy stairwell brought us onto a street that was much too bright in front of a car that was far too dirty. Everything was gray and static, the February clouds never letting up, leaving the world stuck in a purgatory-like chill. I'd almost forgotten about the yellow fluorescent lights and looked up to see dozens of artificial suns apologizing for the real one's absence. We were a few blocks away from the Fifth, a decent morning trek, which meant I'd need to take a day trip to the city's edge to catch a glimpse of the sky.
Roche,
Yuri called to me, grabbing what looked like a parking ticket from the windshield.
For you.
Ah, great. I grabbed the envelope and ripped it open, expecting to see a $5 fine for parking in what was clearly my spot. I was disappointed to see it was, instead, money for me, with an address and some writing on a separate slip of paper in between the bills.
Never a break with her, I said, more to myself than to Yuri.
We got into my Talbot and set off to the hospital, as I had previously dictated to both myself and her that my needs came first. Looking out the window as I drove, storefronts and lamppost banners still had Happy New Year 1934 on them. Nothing ever got done in the lower city unless there was some direct benefit, like Christmas or a speakeasy raid.
You seem troubled, Roche, Yuri mentioned.
Troubled, Yuri, I responded. Those English lessons going well?
Da! Yes. English is not an easy language.
No, it is not. I let the silence fill the car for a moment before I answered his question.
I'm very troubled, Yuri. Shit ain't what I thought it was going to be.
What did you think it would be?
Not terribly monotonous. Not uneasy all the time. Well, a different uneasy. I ain't worrying about people now. I'm worrying about myself.
Da, we should always be worrying about ourselves.
Not like this, Yuri.
We arrived at the address from the letter an hour later, after I had some doctors check some boxes on a sheet and give me a sizable bill to pay. The location was a small shipping office belonging to some members of the Maranzano mob on the southern edge of the meatpacking district, their central shipping hub now that Chelsea belonged to the Iron Hands cartel. Meatpacking was one of the most coveted linchpin strongholds in the city, seeing as mafias would bleed or thrive controlling this shipping giant of an area. Maranzano, an old Italian bastard from the days of the Five Families, controlled most of Midtown Lower Manhattan, save for Chelsea, which I had gifted to the Eye on a silver platter back in mid-October. The Eye, head of the Iron Hands, and my former employer, had been trying to get me to mug up and threaten the mob in meatpacking for a while now. Of course, I never did give her exactly what she wanted. I hadn't gotten a slap on the wrist yet, but I was waiting for it. I told her I needed space, that I was done with this life, but she hadn't taken that seriously. Neither had I. I left the car, leaving Yuri to make sure no one tried to nab it from me, and approached the old office. Knocking on the door revealed three mafiosos on the other side. Mafiosos, Brunos, assholes, all the same. Each with a pistol trained on me as they allowed me access. I brushed past, walking into the building proper, seeing the office space adorned with wood trim, bleached wallpaper, and warm wood furnishings to mask it as some other corporate hole. Men and women of all ethnicities, ages, and walks of life were here, but the top roles were dominated by the Italians. Old habits died hard, it seemed. Still, more inclusive than GE. The goons at the front door strong-armed me to the back end of the office space to where the private offices were, revealing the director of this operation sitting behind a heavy wooden desk. Santoni, Maranzano's personal enforcer. He ran his hand through his crew-cut hair and rubbed the tips of his handlebar mustache, equating picturesqueness to seriousness. The enforcer and some cronies were watching something on a tube TV stuck on top of a filing cabinet, no doubt enjoying themselves as the hard work was done by the drones they had running around this place. Seeing me approach, the rest of the men jumped to attention. Santoni was less on edge, greeting me with open arms, stroking his handlebar mustache as he snapped his fingers to someone. Sitting in a chair opposite him, two fresh beers were placed before us.
"Nightcaller, good to see you," he said in his thick Brooklyn accent. "Been listening to your program?"
"Nah, not a big fan," I responded.
"I have. Gotta say, those writers are getting better. Yes, sir."
He grabbed his beer and sipped, urging me to do the same.
"Heard you saved an orphanage, leaping in and carrying like 10 kids to safety."
I rolled my eyes, hearing him chuckle.
"Ah, best be careful. They're making you seem like a decent member of society." "Maybe I am." "Oh, ho, ho! Our Iron Hand has gotten a bit softer. Might not be scary enough for the rank and file to bend over to after all."
Several gun safeties clicked as they saw me reach for my jacket. I retrieved the slip of paper and read it over again. I almost chuckled. "She wants..." I started reading the paper. Should have skimmed more than the address.
"She's offering a trade to your boss."
"Oh, a trade? Giving us our money and reputation and men back in exchange for nothing? It would only be fair after that cock-up of a killer ravaged the gang."
"That ain't my doing. Fucking hell, it ain't your doing."
He stood and slammed his hands against the tabletop, knocking over my beer. The fermented brew spilled onto the floor, running under the soles of my shoes.
"I didn't see that killer burning down the Eye's safe houses or killing the Eye's men. For all I know, it was you who did that shit to us."
I rested my mechanical hand against the table, tapping my fingers on the varnished wood.
"That same killer gave me this. I ain't a fan of them any more than you are."
Santoni calmed himself and sat down with a thud.
"Fair enough. What's the deal?"
East Village for meatpacking.
No,
Santoni said, and then turned to the other men in the office.
Escort him out.
No,
I asked, making everyone flinch as I stood from my chair.
Asshole, East Village is massive compared to this little dick tip of a neighborhood you got yourself. And unless you need a map, you're square in the middle of the Eye's territory, seeing as she owns Chelsea.
Owns Chelsea, he scoffed. Meatpacking is the illicit shipping heart of New York these days. Besides that, keeping it operational is enough to piss her off, giving us something to hold over her. We ain't folding on this. And I don't need to deliberate with Maranzano to confirm this.
I sighed, puffing out my cheeks and blowing hot air onto the table.
I understand. You might feel brave rejecting this offer, but this will cause shit to stir.
Man, anything will cause shit to stir, Santoni said, leaning toward me. That's how the Eye is. She takes and takes and takes more, and when you got nothing left to give, she offs you. You still got something to give her. Don't you be thinking that you're special. We don't bend, and she understands that we ain't afraid of her. Or you, for that matter.
It ain't me you should be afraid of, Tony.
Oh, yeah? You mean her Kopeck pal? Or yours?
Alan. They knew about Alan, right.
Or are they the same these days?
That last question caught my attention.
If you're insinuating something, spit it out.
I'm just saying, I don't see you working for her much, and I've seen plenty of chrome tops under her employ.
I shook my head.
Just remember where you are. If she decides to make a show of strength, you know the first place she'll go.
Yeah, we know, Santoni said,
turning back to the TV.
And I won't be the one to lead it, I said,
prompting him to give me a second glance. Just a thought. She's a fan of narrow assaults, spearheads. I put money on her moving from north to south through here, cutting this place in half and scattering your forces. Washington Street, most likely.
The fuck you telling me this? You think I'm gonna trust you?
No. I don't care whether you listen or not. But I feel better trying to postpone all-out war. Or at the very least, give you a fighting chance when it eventually happens. Santoni waved me away, his guards escorting me out, giving me a final shove before closing the door behind me.
Confident pricks.
Sure, I wasn't intimidating, but I was unpredictable. And in this line of work, that's more of an investment than just beating some heads in. Yuri was sitting inside the car and smiled, seeing me slide in.
Mr. Roche, did your meeting go well?
More or less, I nodded to him. I tried, at least.
To do what?
To save their skins. Chapter 2. Across town, Alan was dealing with more mob activity that had stained the lower city's reputation. He and his current partner at New York's 5th Precinct, Sergeant Patrick Sinclair, had been scoping out a Maranzano smuggling operation for several weeks, identifying a clothing shop as a hub for military-grade weaponry. Shipments from the mainland had come in, crates were dropped off, and exactly 48 hours later, a fleet of cars came by to collect the goods, bringing them either to the compound or to other safe houses. The men they had skulking in the shadows watching this all but confirmed things, and flexing the newly instituted Racketeering and Cartels Act, or RAC Act, had given the officers on the East Coast a much-needed boost in funding to deal with organized crime and the ability to pin smaller operations on larger organizations. All in all, they had the means and rights to go in guns blazing wherever they chose to. It was early in the morning, an hour before the bulbs turned on, with the streets packed to the brim with people racing either to home from the night shift or to work for the day shift. Their police cruiser was stationed near the southern sidewalk of West 10th, the garment store they were scouting, positioned on the northeast corner of the street. To the north of the corner was a post office, and to the east was a shoe shop. On either side of the store's corner door were two large perpendicular windows, and buffering them from the front entrance were two brick-and-mortar pillars. Inside were a handful of people, five or so. Some entered, others exited. Alan kept his eyes peeled, spotting four automatics entering the premises. He didn't get a good look at their eyes. He sat in the driver's seat of a police cruiser, still feeling strange wearing a blue uniform, which never felt comfortable, no matter how he sat. While it was acceptable to look sharp on desk duty, it was a completely different story in the field. He felt like he had a bullseye on his chest and back with the painfully bright color his uniform had. Sinclair was in the passenger seat, with a cold ice pack balanced on his head and an unloaded M1928 Thompson submachine gun on his lap. The lone 50-round drum magazine was caught between his knees, with both of his hands rubbing his temples.
"Christ, Alan, you drive fast for a metal man."
The machine didn't respond to the statement, allowing Sinclair to continue.
"My head is rolling. I drank way too much last night. What day is it again?"
"It's Wednesday, Sergeant."
Sinclair laughed and pushed the ice pack back from his forehead to his eyes.
"A stakeout is just what I needed."
Alan rolled his eyes hearing that. "Sergeant, we're preparing for a raid."
"Oh, shit, that's today?"
Alan groaned and looked outside. Their objective had been to scout out the aforementioned store for mafia activity, get what evidence they could to pin it to the Maranzano mob, and arrest or kill whoever might be in charge. The very fact that their rules of engagement were so loose weighed heavily on Alan, but then again, it made sense given the fact their Rack Act money was seeded by GE. The incident on Christmas Eve, with the third surrounding a Gould Corporation-owned and Maranzano-claimed store, had suddenly made everyone reevaluate the reach of organized crime in civilian life. More money meant more cops, more guns, and more of a prerogative to prove the money was well spent, no matter the methods employed. Alan looked down the street to the east, seeing three other police cruisers parked 30 feet away, facing the opposite direction, their mirrors positioned as to allow them to see Alan and the storefront. They'd be ready to leap out at a moment's notice. The plate's bulbs began to wane, and Alan pulled the proverbial trigger, loading his high power and unlatching the car door. He noted that the machines never left the store.
"Oh, shit, wait up,"
Sinclair said, throwing down his ice pack and loading his Thompson. Alan approached the store with Sinclair, and the other three cars were emptied of their occupants, a legion of 14 officers in total surrounding the front of the store. Alan didn't mind going in first. Like his friend Toby had said, it would take more than a punch to get through his metal exterior. The men and women on the street quietly scattered, giving the police a wide berth, knowing full well that bullets were about to fly.
"How's Roche doing?"
Sinclair asked casually, stacked up on the opposite side of the store's door. He was far too calm to be part of a raid, probably due to the hangover not allowing him to grasp just how serious this was.
"Doing?" Alan squinted. "I wouldn't know. He sleeps in late and stays out until early in the morning. He says he's working, but..."
"Think he's working his other job?"
"I don't know, Sergeant. There are bigger things to worry about right now. But if I was to guess, I'd say he's been staying on the straight and narrow recently."
"Good to know. I wonder why that..."
The front of the store exploded, glass knives flying out into the street. The remaining foot traffic scattered. A car swerved out of the way of the explosion. Horns blasted and people took cover. Someone screamed. The brick columns near the door had protected Alan and Sinclair from the shockwave, but some of the other officers weren't as lucky. One had been struck in the shoulder with a 6-inch glass shard, but was still alive, thankfully. Alan still felt dazed from the pressure wave. Looking around the brick post and through the broken glass door, he could see the store wasn't demolished, but they wouldn't be reopening anytime soon. The front door had been blasted open.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?